making TV special.
Alice. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means? It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. And it's just afternoon here in the rainy, dreary Portland on October 14th, 2009. But on the line with us from sunny and beautiful East Coast time in Toronto is Zachary Fillingham from GeopoliticalMonitor.com. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So, we were talking just a little bit off mic, and you and I have never spoken before. So, a little bit of this conversation is definitely going to be kind of winging it. And I don't really know too much about you, so how about you tell me, as well as my listeners, just maybe a quick bio, who you are, where you're from, how you got involved in this InfoWar mess.
Well, as you said, my name is Zachary Fillingham. I'm from Toronto, Canada. And I've always been sort of politically active, politically involved. I went to school at York here in Toronto for international relations, and I got an honors BA. And then I went to study in London, England, and completed a master's degree in Chinese studies. And my specialty was Chinese foreign policy, particularly Chinese interests in Central Asia. But I would say that there has been a common thread in my studies that is nationalism. I'm very interested in nationalism, which is sort of, you know, across, well, mainly India and China is my expertise studying it. But anyways, after London, I was lucky enough to study Mandarin for a year in Taipei. And through that, afterwards, I was lucky enough to travel through Asia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan. And then I came back and took up a position writing. And I've been writing for the Geopolitical Monitor for about a year now.
So the website geopoliticalmonitor.com is a website that is relatively new to me, and I only became aware of it because of my collaborations with James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. And we have sort of tried to put together, I suppose, a little bit of a loose partnership where we've all added prominent links to each other on our individual websites. And something I've said time and time again as I talk to folks when I do some of these interviews is that's what's so amazing about, I think, the times that we're living in and the technology that's now available to us is that, again, as we were saying off mic pre-show, you know, I'm a small-town West Virginia boy, but I can talk to folks that are in the UK or in Florida or in Olympia or in Japan or in your case Toronto. And so I think it brings together amazing sort of backgrounds. And this is definitely something I don't think we've probably ever seen before. Where, how old are you, if I can ask?
I am 28.
28. I'm 32. I don't think there's ever really been a time before where there have been the tools and folks of like mind getting together and actually being politically active in such a way. I guess what I'm trying to say is, in decades gone by, guys, you're in our age, would probably either be working a factory job or we'd be out partying it up, you know, doing all those sorts of things. What you did say that you've been politically aware from quite a young age.
Well,
I said, go ahead.
I think it's you raise a very interesting point because you know, when back in uni, the catchphrase was globalization, globalization this, globalization that, and it is a reflection of, you know, sort of globalized communications that we can network like we do. And also, I think it's also, you know, the sites Geopolitical Monitor, Corbett Report, and Media Monarchy, they're all probably born of the same sort of disenchantment with the mainstream media and the coverage of, you know, very important events that appear in the mainstream media. That, I mean, I can't speak for you guys, but I feel that, really misses the mark, and I think there's a lot of important things that, A, aren't covered, and there are important things that are covered, but are covered in an overly simplistic and almost juvenile way. So I think it's very, you know, it's a sign of the times, and it's, you know, it's a positive sign of the times that we can all get together and we can sort of try to push out the haze and all this and create our own alternatives for media.
Now, without getting into the whole conversation of, you know, the threats to internet freedom and all of these technologies, that would be a whole other conversation. But essentially, we can put it quite simply and say that we have these tools, we have them right now, and we're going to use them. So,
totally.
If I bring up right now as we speak, geopoliticalmonitor.com, we see the top of the page, the main story, is the story you filed, and that's U.S. Dollar Condition Terminal. And I told you, as I listened to a little bit of local AM radio here and heard their little corporate top of the news break, it was all the Dow hits over 10,000, and we also have gold trading at over 1,000. So can you break down the U.S. Dollar's condition terminal?
Well, the U.S. And, you know, it's funny because these things, like these events, they're obviously constantly happening. They happen so fast. But basically, Robert Fisk at The Independent wrote this article that basically outlined secret negotiations between some OPEC states and China and Japan to delist petroleum trading from the dollar, and this caused a big dip in the dollar's value, which is sort of just, you know, continuing the trend of basically what's become a bit of a plummet for the dollar now. And the article was written sort of in response to that, as kind of like, I guess the tone of it is that, you know, we're not, I think it's a bit premature to talk about the dollar losing its status as global reserve currency within the next decade. That being said, I mean, sort of events are starting to accelerate over the last week, and there's just this, it's starting to emerge, in my opinion, that the American government might actually be interested in jettisoning the dollar as the global reserve currency, like of their own volition, and sort of dropping the strong dollar policy, which has been a hallmark for the last, I guess, 50 years, which sort of breeds the confidence necessary for the dollar to be a global reserve currency. And that might actually be a conscious decision on the part of the American government. So maybe the schedule has been moved up. Maybe the dollar doesn't have much time as a reserve currency of choice.
It definitely seems like we can make the comparison, and I would agree. It does seem as though there is the conscious, concerted effort, at least somewhat secretly, of actively trying to destroy the dollar. And as we look at other, you know, sorts of government malfeasance and state involvement in things, that on a number of other levels we can look at things and say, well, they made it happen on purpose. So whether we're talking, you know, about 9/11 or about pandemics or about many of these events, they let it happen on purpose.
And I'd say the biggest one by far, I mean, and the real confidence-shattering reality that's going on right now is that, you know, the stated deficit is, I guess, $1.3 trillion, give or take, and some conservative think tanks even put it up at $2 trillion. So that's the inescapable reality that you just cannot get around, that will destroy the value of the dollar. And it will continue to slide, in my opinion, until interest rates are hiked. And, of course, we all know that's probably going to decapitate any economic recovery. So,
we, at least here in the States, there has been, again, as we've talked about, you know, sort of a whole new generation of people becoming activated, there's a large push to expose or end or at least audit the Federal Reserve. What is your take on that move? And it, of course, centers around not only Ron Paul, but his bill that now, of course, has tons of co-sponsors, H.R. 1207, the Audit the Fed bill.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, admittedly, I'm not too familiar with that because I tend to focus on foreign issues, but I would say I mean, I'm always for any sort of third-party outside authentication and auditing of any of these institutions, because they're rife with, if not overt corruption, then just terrible models and terrible predictions, terrible, you know, reporting.
Well, so if I, you know, if I'm coming at it from a, you know, an American-centric, you know, knowledge, because that's where I am, that's what I know. I haven't actually traveled outside of, you know, the United States borders. So let's actually then maybe add to the mix my neighbors to the north and south, Mexico and Canada. Do you see within this changing monetary policy? I know we've heard a lot of talk about, you know, this supposed Amero and a possible North American Union and all those sorts of things. Do you see any comparison between that and perhaps the European Union?
Well, personally, I actually do. I think that is a possibility down the road, especially because the overwhelming pull of international society as American hegemony declines, which is basically, I mean, eventually this sort of the pressure of the deficits is going to take it. It's going to hit the American military budget, right? And that's going to scale back America's ability to sort of police the world and sort of like and take away some of the positive aspects of America's international presence, like say maybe international confidence in the safety of shipping lanes and stuff like that. So I would say that the overall trend in that kind of environment will be regionalism, and I think that Canada and Mexico will be pulled closer to America, and possibly, I mean, there could be a common currency down the road, because you're going to be competing with things like the EU, and you know, probably regional bloc in East Asia as well, because you know, China, Japan, and Korea recently, I think last week, met for a summit to discuss similar plans, which is complicated in East Asia because Korea and China think back to the East Asian co-prosperity sphere, you know, so that one might be a bit longer time coming. But the new president of Japan, the DPJ's Hatoyama, that's one of his big platforms, is to pull Japan closer into the East Asian orbit. So overall, you might see internationally, regionalism is going to become more and more prominent, in my opinion.
Now, and as some of the other things that we talked about going over, and again, you know, I think it's great that I can get, you know, your perspective on these things, that again is more global, is more international, and again, I can only sometimes gather and piece together what I'm kind of soaking up in my daily life. So I suppose, what are some of the other things on the international scene that you find interesting or disturbing?
Well, I'd say that I think that over the next 20 years, the big story is going to be America hegemonic decline as a mouthful. But and what kind of that's going to have a series of side effects on the international environment. You know, it's not like, I think a lot of people hear that hegemonic decline, and it's got kind of alarmist tones to it. It's, you know, it sort of drums up, you know, images of like chaos and whatnot. But it's actually, I think it's going to be a lot more straightforward. There's going to be no real disasters, in my opinion. It's just going to be basically a sort of realignment of international power politics, probably, like as we were just speaking of, along regional lines. And America's not going to go away. America's going to be one of many, you know, powers in a multipolar international society. That's going to have a huge impact on the way that international politics go. And that's going to create a whole whack of new possible sources of conflict, as well as new possible sources for peace. So it'll be interesting to see. And it's an interesting time right now that we're in, because it's a big transition. It's going to be a big transition.
So was there much to make from you know, we've seen this recent resurgence in the talk about striking Iran. Now, whether that would be the U.S. or the U.K. or Israel or some proxy between those and others, do you think there's a reality to this, or is it? It seems like it's something that's popped up and gone away over the last several years. That it sometimes is almost used as a fear stick to sort of bring up and beat people with a little bit.
I think there's always a reality to it, because I mean, like, one thing that makes international politics so interesting is the fact that, you know, states don't always do what's in their interest. They don't always do the best thing. Under that, foreign policy are layers of domestic politics, and you know, democracy, there's the obvious pressures of your population that want you to do something or not do something on the foreign front. But even countries like China, you know, even if they're authoritarian governments, they feel pressures. In China's case, sort of nationalistic pressures to adopt a certain tone towards Japan or whatnot. But it's always possible, I think, that, you know, government's just a series of interest groups, so it just depends on which ones, you know, climbing up to the top of the mound and which one can pound their agenda through. That being said, I think it would be a terrible idea.
I was actually making a note there, but I was writing down governments are a collection of interest groups.
Well, that's true. You know, I mean, like, I'd say it's true everywhere. And, you know, in America, there's lobbying, which is kind of just an overt example of that. That, like, you know, you can get the ear of the government directly.
If you have the money to get yourself into that spot.
But it's got a nice democratic veneer on the outside. Like, you think, you know, you picture a guy with hat in hand lining up to talk to a friend. It doesn't really work like that, but it'd be nice.
Yeah, that it's, you know, oh gosh, you know, golly gee, Mr. Representative, it sure would be nice if you do this thing. However, it may be cases where there's a briefcase that pops open.
Yeah. Actually, funnily enough, I just learned about this in China. There's a similar tradition where you can, you know, like the peasant or anyone in the country could go to Beijing and petition the emperor with, you know, corruption. So they just go to the Forbidden City and line up, and then they, you know, supposedly the emperor would see them. But the CCP has recently ended it, and people stop coming to Beijing.
That's, you know, and there's something in, you know, in the First Amendment, in the U.S. Constitution, the one bit that most people forget about, you know, when they, you know, it's, you know, freedom of press and speech and assembly. But one that people a lot of times miss is the right to, you know, petition the government for redress of grievances. That you have the right, you know, to have your grievances heard and to get an answer to that. That seems to be, you know, I think it makes sense that people forget that out of the First Amendment, because we don't seem to really honor that. There don't really seem to be too many forthcoming answers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, you know, I think it's important to keep that in mind, though. And Iran's a good example. You know, it's probably, for all intents and purposes, a terrible idea, but it's always possible.
And is it going to be a situation, again, where we see, you know, I worry, you know, I'm going to wake up one morning and bring up the news and see, you know, that Israel or the U.S. has pulled some overnight bunker buster strike into Iran?
I think... If the fact that Israel has not and will not is not due to the fact that Israel doesn't want to or isn't willing to. It's more due to the fact that it's logistics. I think it would take a lot of sorties for the Israeli Air Force to accomplish the mission. I think they would take a lot of casualties, and it's not necessarily a sure thing, especially given the revelation of a calm facility. It increases the amount of sorties required to properly take out, you know, Iran's nuclear facilities, all of them. So I think it's more of a logistic problem for Israel. And as it stands right now, I think it would be the Obama administration would definitely be pressuring Israel not to take that approach.
Well, and that brings up, I don't know if you saw, I believe it's now been a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, one of Obama's main advisors, Mr. Trilateral himself and the author of The Grand Chessboard, Zbigniew Brzezinski basically came out and said, you know, Obama needs to tell Israel that we will attack them if they try to attack Iran.
Well, that would be Obama attacking his re-election prospects. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, like, with Israel, it's a difficult situation because, like we were just talking about the domestic politics element. It's not so much, you know, what the best foreign policy is. It's these domestic political considerations that you need to take into account. And threatening to attack Israel would be probably political suicide in the States. Don't you agree?
I would, and it's the fear, in a way, is that, you know, that it's logistics, but it's also, you know, a lot of times they need the political capital to be able to do things. So a lot of these things, and when we talk about, well, you know, I'll attack you if you try and attack them while they're... It brings up, you know, the specter of things like the USS Liberty or the Gulf of Tonkin and these sort of, you know, shady war-starting events that end up being, you know, these sort of catalyzing events that then our misleaders can use as the political capital to, of course, do the things they wanted to do already.
Yeah. Well, the Obama administration's having a real hard time with Israel. I mean, they out of the gates, they tried to, you know, they tried to play bad cop, but the Netanyahu government's having none of it. So there's just this sort of this impasse. It's almost like, I don't know, it's very counterproductive for the region. The peace process isn't going anywhere. Israel's definitely not on side when it comes to Iran, and it's just nothing, you know, nothing's getting done there.
Well, and now we've mentioned both Obama and peace in the same sentence, so now I have to bring up and ask you about what's your take on the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, I think I was as shocked as everyone. I think that, you know, you've never seen such a unanimous wave of, like, what the fuck? Yeah.
Exactly. You know, when you hear, you know, and I don't know if it was on the LA Times or where I saw it, you know, folks have said, it was like, gee, when I woke up this morning, I thought maybe The Onion had hacked into CNN.
Yeah, the biggest coup. But, and it was interesting to read the Nobel panel's defense of their decision, which was essentially like, hey, check out that speech he gave in Cairo. It was pretty peaceful. But it's like, you know, it's a shame, too, because it hurts him, in my opinion. I mean, like, you know, it's just like, I don't know. It's like people are going to start to resent him. It's like, oh, you know, you have everyone under your spell, even the Nobel, you know, panel.
And that was something I think that both, you know, both what I call the fake left and the fake right here in the States would probably agree on, is that, well, he probably doesn't really deserve it, and you're only giving more, you know, ammunition for the people who hate him to, you know, to attack him with. Just so now you have, again, one of the fake conservatives. This gives them more to rabble about.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, like, you gotta feel sorry for him in a way. He probably picks up the paper, you know, that day's paper, and he's like, oh, man.
I read that actually his daughters told him that morning. So I'm sure when his daughters told him, he thought, oh, you know, they just misunderstood something.
They're taking the piss.
So, well, and one other thing, I think I saw it written that he could have or should have, you know, basically rejected it, you know, just sort of say, you know, I don't deserve this, I won't accept, you know, the award.
Well, I mean, it's up to him.
Yeah, and that ship has sailed. It's far too late to do that now. He would have had to have done it, you know, that very day.
Yeah. I mean, he joins a long tradition of sort of sketchy Nobel Peace Prize winners.
That's true. Now is in the fine company of Kissinger and...
Yeah, eyebrow raisers.
Well, what else on the geopolitical scene? I know, you know, we've got China and Russia and gas and trade deals.
Yeah. You know, China's always interesting. China's, like, constantly shocking me with their sort of ruthlessly pragmatic foreign policy. They just signed a $7 billion mining deal in Guinea. And, you know, that's pretty unpopular. They're basically picking up, you know, economic benefits around the periphery of all the places where, the Western world won't touch because of human rights and those kind of, you know, principled stands. And I think it's very interesting. I'm thinking of writing an article on the Chinese media, because the Chinese, I don't know if it's Xinhua or CCTV, but they're going to launch a global news channel soon, and they're going to use it for that sort of soft, you know, projection of Chinese soft power, sort of presents the Chinese view internationally, which I think will be very interesting, because China, like the CCP's method of control, you know, back in the day, the Cultural Revolution is very overt, right? Obviously, if you weren't revolutionary, you're thrown off the top of a building or whatever. But, you know, it's sort of evolved into this sort of, like, self-supporting system of, you know, I guess you'd say brainwashing in a way, but it's more like, it's almost softer than that, you know? You just, like patriotism is taught in schools and stuff. And patriotism is taught basically through the lens of the CCP being the national savior of China. And usually that's at the expense of Japan, because they're the national savior, you know, insofar that they helped defeat Japan. Japan was so terrible, et cetera, et cetera. But basically nowadays, you know, the CCP is supported by the fact that people have sort of internalized their education to the point where to criticize the CCP is to be unpatriotic. So the CCP has successfully turned nationalism or patriotism into, like, their own domain. And, you know, that's, I mean, like, I think it's clear that's obviously very helpful when it comes to the prospects of the CCP, you know, perpetuating themselves into the future. But they're probably going to aim to do the same thing with this international media push. It's going to be a sort of soft, indirect, you know. It's going to be, I mean, I'm quite looking forward to it, too. Like, I know what they're up to. Watch the reports.
That you can sort of, yeah, watch it and analyze it. And, you know, the first thing that pops into my head is, you know, we think of, you know, Fox News here as being a, you know, sort of mouthpiece of, you know, mainstream kind of government thought, or at least, you know, depending on which party is in power.
Yeah. But and it's interesting, Fox News, you know, Fox News is probably, I mean, like, I don't know how is Fox News perceived in America? Because it's definitely, in Canada, it's perceived as, like, barely a news network.
That's the funny thing, the general, you know, consensus, and again, that's what's tough. I live in Portland, so I live in a generally left-leaning, you know, environment where, you know, everyone I know would basically, you know, Fox News, yeah, that's a bunch of garbage.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that, you know, middle America segment, you know, or the joke being, you know, that space between, you know, Manhattan and L.A. called America.
Mm-hmm.
That essentially, it's, you know, it's all over the place there. And again, you know, I'm small town West Virginia boy. It's all over the place there.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay, so we can take Fox News as an example of something that's obvious. Well, I mean, to me, quite obviously perpetuating a sort of right-wing culture, like very indirectly, very sneakily. Actually, sometimes not sneakily at all.
Sometimes very, yeah, ham-fisted, obvious.
Like, yeah, grabbing your head and shoving it in the, you know, puddle or something. Here it is. But, yeah, so that's sort of, it's the same thing, but it's got a domestic audience in mind. China's going for the, you know, projected internationally, so that you know, if governments in the West find that some point down the line they want to sort of start saber rattling towards China, I guess the CCP's hope is that their news network will sort of propagate this idea that don't pick on China. China's not that bad.
Well, and if they'll be, you know, the sort of the biggest around, you know, anybody that's in that position, if you're in the spot to have, you know, the most amount of coverage and listeners and channels and all those sorts of things, then a lot of times, unfortunately, those who have the loudest, largest voice sometimes win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, Chinese nationalism, it's definitely something to look out for, Chinese patriotism.
And it seems as though that, you know, that China kind of is the model that, and again, that some, you know, fear and speculate here in the States that, you know, in a way that we're kind of following that model.
Oh, as far as national, like as far as patriotism goes?
As far as the patriotism and the sort of allegiance to the state, you know, that I think you're talking about, it becomes so just sort of almost subtle that you're grown up with it.
Yeah, you know what I actually liken it to? And I've raised this up, I was actually a big proponent of this back when I was doing my master's degree, but no one seemed to agree with me. I mean, technically it's fascism. Is it not? I mean, if it's an authoritarian state that's sort of underpinned by, you know, nationalism. And furthermore, in the Chinese case, there is somewhat of a racial element to the nationalism. I mean, like, to me, back in the day, I was taught that that was fascism. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Well, and there, you know, when there are all the isms that are thrown around a lot, and we sometimes forget exactly what they mean, but, you know, as I've heard, you know, folks like Webster Tarpley explain, you know, that fascism, you know, isn't necessarily the top-down kind of rule, that it's almost from the bottom up. And I think it would kind of go along with the idea that, you know, again, you kind of police yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Where when you're grown up, I keep saying that, when you're growed up and you, these things are put into your head, you know, at the state-run school. So in a way, you almost don't need tons of stormtroopers stomping down the street, because it's almost the panopticon idea that you just pretty much have to assume that you are being kind of watched at all times, and you end up policing yourself.
I know, and you know what the most interesting thing is? You're, most of the time you're being watched by your neighbors and, like, your peers, because, like, if you start displaying, if you start raging out, like, you know what, fuck the CCP. You know, screw the CCP, you know, they're not my China, you know. Like, I want a better China without the CCP. And to other people, that's like, you know, your sort of subversive element. You hate China.
And
so,
that's the brown shirts, isn't it? That's when, you know, your neighbors are going to rat you out for things. And again, that's, I think, a fundamental of fascism. It came, you know, from sort of the left, you know, the upstarts and the grassroots, you know, and those are the people, those are your neighbors, those are the people you're around, and those will be the people who will start to say, you know, whatever the case may be, that you're not recycling correctly, or you're criticizing the state, you know, they're going to rat you out for their, you know, however many pieces of gold.
And it's interesting, because China might actually have a problem in the way that they've fostered this nationalism, because sometimes they can't, they've opened Pandora's box and they can't cram it all back in, because there are certain events that happen that are beyond the control of the CCP. Like certain things can happen with Japan, or actually a big one was when the Chinese embassy was bombed for the NATO campaign in Yugoslavia. Former Yugoslavia, in Kosovo.
Okay. And I had to think for a moment there that there was a story within this last year that started that again, what essentially looked like a random kind of gangland murder in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is all those towns, all that center around Washington, D.C., whether it's Loudoun or Reston or Alexandria or all this place, you know, they're all pretty close. And you know that the majority of the folks that are around there have all been involved, you know, in government jobs. There was a guy named William Bennett who was beaten to death early this year. I believe it was in February. Then you find out he was a CIA guy. Then you find out he had something to do with the, you know, botched, or however it may have gone, that led to the bombing of that embassy.
Really?
And I found Media Monarchy started to get a lot of interesting traffic from China. And it's interesting to note as well that a lot of it was coming from the sort of like VPNs or proxy sites.
Mm-hmm.
So that they were sort of, you know, they probably couldn't bring up MediaMonarchy.com when, I don't know if you ever checked out the site Great Firewall of China. It would let you sort of test your website and see if it's blocked in China.
Oh, really?
The site is still up, but they don't vouch for the accuracy anymore. But a couple of years ago, MediaMonarchy.com wasn't making it through. So this story of the bombing of this embassy, to me, as I started to look over the other side and kind of compare it to things that we study here in the States, this bombing seemed to be a sort of, you know, a seminal event to the people there, just as events here in the States that we look at and that we're suspicious of, again, whether it's 9/11 or the UK 7/7. So it was kind of a fascinating window, and again, just to try and chart the connections.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting. I mean, like, it's just interesting between two states, you know, one event, how different it's perceived. Because, I mean, you know, in China, that was a big deal. And that, you know, there were massive protests. CCP had trouble containing them, like sort of just unleashed this anti-Americanism that was really hard to put back in the box. And the CCP was scared, right? The CCP fears any sort of mass political movement, no matter what the content is. They fear anything they can't, you know, any sort of political organization or outburst that they can't control. So instead, they're busting out the people to the protests and just sort of, like, I guess, idly watching, being like, yeah, this is fine. But then it gets to this point where it's just exploding, and they're like, oh my God, what the hell do we do? And that's the sort of thing, you know, they create this nationalism, but it can become a weapon. And it also can become something that controls you, too, because, you know, foreign policy-wise, stuff, you know, they become beholden to it. So. And there's also the spy plane crash right before 9/11. There's this...
Yeah, actually, no. Tell me about that. It's not ringing a bell.
It was, I believe it was April 2001. And it was near Hainan Island, which is just off the south coast of China. And it's actually where their submarine base is in the South China Sea. An American spy plane collided with a Chinese fighter jet, and the American survived, but the Chinese pilot died. And the Chinese held the American pilot for about 8 days or something. It was a big international event. It also sort of kicked off a huge round of anti-American sort of protests all across China. But it's sort of like, the wind was taken out of the whole ordeal by 9/11 eventually happening, and then that sort of everything changed. There's this, you know, their anger turned to sympathy, the rest is history, blah, blah, blah.
So, and I shouldn't be surprised, because it's a fantastic website, the History Commons, historycommons.org, I found the story. March 31st, 2001, U.S. spy plane crashes in China, Chinese strip plane of sensitive equipment.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, ruthlessly pragmatic, as always.
There you go.
And I mean, I don't want to give the impression that I think that China's going to be a problem moving forward in this sort of realigned international environment. I think that they have as much invested in the sort of international economic system as you know, America. Yeah, someone just wrote a book called Super Economy, how America and China are the same economy. And it's almost true. Like, they are, like, so, you know, they're both stakeholders in the present international economic model. So, unlike the sort of rise and fall of great powers in the past, where, you know, the challengers were always left out of the system, so they sort of raged against it, I think that China will come to be a sort of play by the rules, nice international player.
Well, and perhaps in a way, you know, that these two, you know, nations that are, you know, seem so different, could perhaps, you know, we could have them as, you know, the thesis and the antithesis, and put together and make a synthesis that we could see some kind of morphing of the two. I mean, and I don't mean, you know, physically or any kind of thing like that, but, you know, just in the ideals and
actually,
the structures.
That's a good point. Sorry, I just thought something. I have a question for you, though. Just, you know, talking about America and China, makes you think about human rights. Do you think that human rights will be as important if this sort of, you know, greater competition in the international environment comes to pass in the next couple decades?
That's definitely something that I know folks here in the States, again, as we've seen some of the things with, you know, contaminated food, or with the things that we learn about, you know, sweatshop labor and things like that, that these things do kind of make up the unspoken kind of undercurrent for things. And we don't seem to talk too much about, you know, some of these human rights violations and things. I guess, are you basically asking, you know, what do folks in the States think about, you know, the human rights situation in China?
Well, the human rights situation in China plays into it. But I kind of meant, like, as a sort of, because it plays, you know, over the last 10 years, it's played pretty large into international relations. Like, you know, the half of the Iraq invasion was WMDs. But, you know, the sort of the B-team explanation was, well, you got this dictator and he's so mean, you know?
And he used, you know, chemical weapons on his people that, of course, we sold to him.
So, like, human rights is definitely sort of a, it's much more than before. It's an element in foreign policy. It's a consideration in foreign policy, like whether or not to deal with the state. And China obviously has made it very clear that they don't really care. I mean, obviously there are many criticisms levied towards them, what they do inside China. But they're signing deals with Sudan, Guinea, you know, Burma, anywhere, you know. Like, the whole world is their playing field. And sort of as the Western countries sit back, they're losing out on these opportunities in these states that they are self-imposed. You know?
I think I'm starting to get what you're... That essentially because we may be, you know, held back, for lack of a better word, from getting involved with other nations because, you know, sort of morally, again, for lack of a better word, we can't really be in bed with those guys because internationally, you know, you're seen as, you know, as being, you know, bad to your people and, you know, wrong for all these reasons. So are you saying, yeah, that maybe essentially China, you know, doesn't really care and doesn't really concern itself with those kind of concerns because it has a broader, you know, broader agenda in line?
Oh, I'm saying that, what China does is very, very pragmatic. It's very self-interested. It knows it has problems internally. It knows those problems could be played upon by outside powers. So it promotes a model of international society that benefits itself, which is basically you never meddle in another state's internal affairs. So when it deals with these terrible human rights regimes, it's always on the basis that it's business.
It's just business.
Yeah, exactly. So that helps China, but America has been able to. America, being the preeminent power in the world, along with the EU, have been able to exert a lot of pressure on countries to sort of, in the human rights sense, because like if you're not dealing with the U.S. and the EU generally, in the last decade, then you're really hurting yourself. But as China starts to become an actual tenable alternative, then the EU and U.S. will be sort of, there's going to be a big think through on this, because it's like, you know, will human rights continue to be a big determinant in our foreign policy whenever we say, no, we're not going to deal with you for human rights? China just swoops in and goes, all right, what do you guys want?
We'll do it, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose that is an interesting angle that, you know, and if China, you know, is always acting ruthlessly pragmatic, is the United States acting, you know, sort of foolishly idealistically?
Yeah. Well, I only think about it because, like, in Burma, there's been a recent U-turn for the U.S. in Burma, which has been formally, just sanctions, we're not going to deal with you. And then all of a sudden, Hillary Clinton... it's like, okay, we're going to deal with you now. And it's just like, okay, what's changed? Yeah. And this might be one of the things that changed, because India and China are, deepening their engagement with Burma, and America is just sort of, the U.S. has had to sit on the sidelines, sort of from their self-imposed, moral view. And then I guess, something gave, and they're like, okay, it's time to work with Burma. And they'll probably, over the next couple of years, they're going to scale back sanctions and actually fully engage. So, interesting.
Well, and I'm looking right now at a report 3 days ago from the French agency press, High Hurdles for IMF on the Road to New World Order. The International Monetary Fund, rising from villain to savior through the fires of the global economic crisis, faces steep hurdles in trying to transform into the champion of the New World Order. The IMF's annual meetings with the World Bank in Istanbul last week showcased the newfound punching weight of the major emerging economies like China and India.
Yeah, the IMF just recently issued about $150 billion, I think, worth of bonds in SDR's special drawing rights, which a lot of people hold up as a possible replacement to the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. And the U.S. and the EU can't afford to buy them. So basically, BRIC countries swooped them up. And I think China got $50 billion worth themselves. And, you know, so basically the IMF is now, you know, the BRIC countries are the IMF's creditors. So I think that was a calculated move to sort of make sure that they are intimately involved in whatever new order, if there is to be one, comes out of the IMF. Because the IMF is actually, you know, well, I mean, it's tipped to be, you know, this sort of organizing principle of whatever's coming next.
Well, in this report from the AFP ties into then another report from you that was posted up October 2nd on geopoliticalmonitor.com. China and India, the new naval arms race. Can you explain BRIC countries?
BRIC countries. I mean, BRIC countries, it's actually kind of, you know, it probably shouldn't be used as much as it is because, I think I mentioned that in that article too. It implies a level of cordiality between them that doesn't exist. Like, there's no international accord or anything between what we call the BRIC countries.
I wasn't sure, but I actually just clicked the link and saw it. Brazil, Russia, India, China, BRIC, BRIC.
Yeah.
So that's okay.
And there are, you know, the Geopolitical Monitor recently has sort of made BRIC countries one of its focuses because BRIC countries are, like, they're going to be extremely important for, I mean, they already are. China, obviously. India, obviously, is probably a couple steps behind China, but in some ways they have a healthier economy insofar that they have a sort of healthy level of domestic consumption, whereas China is still primarily export-based. Brazil is in a very stable energy position, as well as, you know, developing their own economy. They recently got the Olympics. They're going to be, I mean, they are the regional power of South America. And Russia, which I just read an article today. I mean, obviously Russia's got some internal political problems, but, I mean, they are sitting on a huge amount of energy wealth, and that's going to be very important moving forward. They're first in natural gas, proven natural gas reserves, eighth in the world in oil reserves, but they're pumping out that oil really quickly. I think they just... I read something today that said they surpassed Saudi Arabia's top oil producer currently. I mean, that goes up and down because it depends on what field is output and what. But I think at present, they are to the top. So they are very well placed. But, you know, the BRIC countries, for various reasons, are going to be, I mean, like, they're going to be extremely important in a multipolar world for whatever reason. I mean, and you know, you could say the EU as well, but obviously the EU has some issues to work out as far as political cohesion and military go. I mean, with all the problems they have, the Lisbon Treaty, I don't know if they'll ever get a sort of unitary military.
That's actually something. One of the things I did want to hit before we start to wind down here is the EU and the recent Lisbon Treaty and the possibility of, you know, Tony Blair becoming the head of the EU. What's your quick take on the European Union situation?
The European Union, I think it's a very long shot if they'll ever pull it together military-wise. It expanded too wide. It's too, you know, the membership's too wide now. it becomes very, very hard for them to form a consensus. And there's a lot of paranoia about voting systems that give France and Germany too much weight. Tony Blair being the new president is possible. I mean, Berlusconi came out for him today. Maybe it would help, help for David Cameron not raising a fuss about the Lisbon Treaty, which he's threatening to do if he gets elected next year. But
when we see the Czech Republic president saying, not going to sign on. He seems to be one of the few sort of, holdouts to a lot of these things and the rejector on things when it comes to, the sort of international, carbon cap and trade schemes and all those things.
Yeah, and David Cameron also actually included the importance, he qualified his statement by saying he's only going to call a referendum for the Lisbon Treaty if everyone else hasn't already ratified it. So if the Czech president can hold out that long, then David Cameron has claimed that he's going to call a referendum on it for Britain. But, I mean, it raises an interesting question, all this, is, because the Lisbon Treaty will do much to consolidate the EU's international diplomatic, structures into one. There'll be like a EU foreign minister, in quotation marks. I don't even know what they call it. I don't think they call it a foreign minister. And they're thrown around proposals. There's actually an article on this at the Geopolitical Monitor, which I think I wrote last week. Oh, sorry, it's a forecaster, so it's blocked for 2 weeks. But so they're gonna these pilot plans produce embassies around the world and stuff like that. But you gotta ask yourself, how much is diplomatic influence affected by military power?
Well, go ahead. Sorry.
And the ability to like the ability to have the leadership structure to sort of deploy it in a timely and comprehensive fashion.
Well, man, as I, sort of am here hastily clicking around on geopoliticalmonitor.com, the site is beautiful. I love just even, just kind of the physical layout of it. And you guys have tons of information. You've got, sections on military and politics and economy and energy security and covert ops, and then a lot of the sort of continental areas of the globe. You mentioned just something right there about a forecast. So as we start to wrap it up here, can you maybe just tell folks, how geopoliticalmonitor.com works and some of the subscriptions and how folks can get involved?
I think I'm not familiar totally with the subscription. I think it might be about $60 a year, but the subscription will get you access to the forecasters when they're written, and the audio for them, the podcast, which is me and another editor at the Geopolitical Monitor kind of having a 15-minute conversation about the wider implications of whatever the forecaster was written on. The forecaster itself is based on hypothesizing on where an event is going to go, which is always difficult, but we do our best. And what could possibly happen next? The situation report is just kind of an in-depth report on a given event, and those are always free, as are the backgrounders, which are even more in-depth, sort of have a historical aspect to them and sort of explain the players. Like some of the recent backgrounders were the BRIC country energy security report, which basically goes through the energy reserves of all the BRIC countries and what their energy situations are. For example, Russia's is pretty good, and China's is, fairly, very dependent on imports. There's lots of good stuff there. And while I'm plugging things, I
actually was just about to go there, so yeah, go ahead.
if you're also interested about what we were talking about in Chinese nationalism at all, I have a blog that's www.zachwrites.com, which posts sort of a bit of wider analysis from the Geopolitical Monitor stuff and just, this or that. There's some humor articles there as well. But I do post Chinese translations from Xinhua, and I try to pick the funniest ones as, you know, in regards to patriotism. So there's some funny stuff there.
So it would be things, again, you know, if we didn't have a translation, these would be some of the articles that folks would never see in the States.
Right.
Those sorts of things. It's meant for them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, because they're not going to, you know, like, here, one of them is Tibet Auntie recalls asking Hu Jintao to dance. She was nervous. So it's all about this, you know, ethnic Tibetan lady during the National Day celebrations asking, you know, Hu Jintao to dance when he was sort of mingling with the crowd. And, you know, she describes him as, you know, oh, you know, I thought he was going to be so hoity-toity, like a uptight leader, but he's really nice, and blah, 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 so sincere. So it's, you know, I think it's funny.
it sounds bizarre.
Yeah, it is bizarre.
Well, man, unless you have any other, you know, sort of closing words of wisdom or warning for folks, anything, you know, you want to leave people with?
No, I just, I'm very, very thankful that you had me. It was a lot of fun, and I really love Media Monarchy, and keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot, brother. I appreciate it, man. And I definitely think we'll have to do this again, and perhaps, you know, maybe focus on one particular area and kind of do a more straight-ahead, you know, analysis of a particular situation.
Yeah, for sure.
So you've got ZachWrites.com, and that's ZachWrites.com, as well as GeopoliticalMonitor.com. And again, folks, these are just, you know, all the amazing new alternative news websites that are being put up from basically, you know, folks all around the world, young and old, black and white, male and female, who are seizing these tools and using them to basically get information out about what's really going on in the world. So, Zachary Fillingham from GeopoliticalMonitor.com, thanks for coming on MediaMonarchy.com. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
All right, man. Take care.
No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. All around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, we're spiteful and hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them.
Combining music and stylized images,
it's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
I want my breath to be.
And the
concludes our program for tonight.
Yep.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.